as you would have them do unto you. There are people who believe that the Golden Rule philosophy is nothing more than a theory and that it is in no way connected with an immutable law. They have arrived at this conclusion because of personal experience wherein they rendered service to others without enjoying the benefits of direct reciprocation. How many have not rendered service to others that was neither reciprocated nor appreciated? I am sure that I have had such an experience, not once, but many times, and I am equally sure that I will have similar experiences in the future. But I will not discontinue rendering service to others merely because they neither reciprocate nor appreciate my efforts. And here is the reason. When I render service to another, or indulge in an act of kindness, I store away in my subconscious mind the effect of my efforts, which may be likened to the charging of a battery. By and by, if I indulge in a sufficient number of such acts, I will have developed a positive, dynamic character that will attract people who harmonize with or resemble my own character. Those whom I attract to me will reciprocate the acts of kindness and the service that I have rendered others. Thus, the law of compensation will have balanced the scales of justice for me, bringing back from one source the results of service that I rendered through an entirely different source. You have often heard it said that a salesman's first sale should be to himself, which means that unless he first convinces himself of the merits of his wares, he will not be able to convince others. Here again is the same law of attraction. Enthusiasm is contagious, and when a salesman shows great enthusiasm over his wares, he will arouse in the minds of others corresponding interest. You can comprehend this law quite easily by regarding yourself as sort of a human magnet that attracts those whose characters harmonize with your own dominating characteristics and repels all who do not so harmonize. Also, keep in mind that you are the builder of that magnet and that you may change its nature so that it will correspond to any ideal that you may wish to conform to. Again, and most important of all, remember that this entire process of change takes place through thought. Your character is but the sum total of your thoughts and deeds. This truth has been stated in many different ways throughout this course. Because of this great truth, it is impossible for you to render any useful service or indulge in any act of kindness toward others without benefiting thereby. Moreover, it is just as impossible for you to indulge in any destructive act or thought without paying the penalty and the loss of a corresponding degree of your own power. Positive thought develops a dynamic personality. Negative thought develops a personality of an opposite nature. In many of the preceding lessons of this course, as in this one, instructions are given as to the exact method of developing your personality through positive thought. These instructions are particularly detailed in Lesson 3, Volume 1, on self-confidence. In that lesson, you have a very definite formula to follow. All of the formulas provided in this course are for the purpose of helping you to consciously direct the power of thought in the development of a personality that will attract to you those who will be of help in the attainment of your definite chief aim. You need no proof that your hostile or unkind acts toward others bring the effects of retaliation. Moreover, this retaliation is usually definite and immediate. Likewise, you need no proof that you can accomplish more by dealing with others in such a way that they will want to cooperate with you. If you have mastered the 8th lesson, Volume 2, on self-control, you now understand how to induce others, through your own attitude toward them, to act toward you as you wish them to act. The law of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is based on the self-same law as that on which the Golden Rule operates. This is nothing more than the law of retaliation. Even the most selfish person will respond to this law. They cannot help it. If I speak ill of you, even though I tell the truth, you will not think kindly of me. Furthermore, you will most likely retaliate in kind. But if I speak of your virtues, you will think kindly of me, and in the majority of instances, when there is an opportunity, you will reciprocate in kind. Through the operation of this law of attraction, the uninformed are constantly attracting trouble and grief and hatred and opposition from others by their unguarded words and destructive acts. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, bearing in mind that human nature has a tendency to retaliate in kind. Confucius must have been thinking of the law of retaliation when he stated the Golden Rule philosophy in somewhat this way. Do not unto others that which you would not have them do unto you. And he might well have added an explanation to the effect that the reason for his injunction was based on that very tendency of man to retaliate in kind. Those who do not understand the law upon which the Golden Rule is based will argue that it will not work when people are inclined toward the law of retaliation. If they would go a step further in their reasoning, they would understand that they are looking at the negative effects of this law and that the selfsame law is capable of producing positive effects as well. In other words, if you would not have your own eye plucked out, then insure against this misfortune by refraining from plucking out the other fellow's eye. Furthermore, render the other fellow an act of kindly, helpful service, and through the operation of this same law of retaliation, he will render you a similar service. And if he should fail to reciprocate your kindness, what then? You will have profited nevertheless, because of the effect of your act on your own subconscious mind. Thus, by indulging in acts of kindness and always applying the Golden Rule philosophy, you are sure of benefit from one source, and at the same time, you have a pretty fair chance of profiting from another source. It might happen that you would base all of your acts toward others on the Golden Rule without enjoying any direct reciprocation for a long period of time. It might also happen that those to whom you rendered those acts of kindness would never reciprocate. In the meantime, however, you have been strengthening your own character, and sooner or later, this positive character that you have been building will begin to assert itself, and you will discover that you have been receiving compound interest on compound interest in return for those acts of kindness that appeared to have been wasted on those who neither appreciated nor reciprocated them. Remember that your reputation is made by others, but your character is made by you. You want your reputation to be a favorable one, but you cannot be sure that it will be, because that is outside of your own control, in the minds of others. It is what others believe you to be. With your character, it is different. Your character is what you are as the results of your thoughts and deeds. You control it. You can make it weak, good, or bad. When you are satisfied and know in your mind that your character is above reproach, you need not worry about your reputation, for it is as impossible for your character to be destroyed or damaged by anyone except yourself as it is to destroy matter or energy. It was this truth that Emerson had in mind when he wrote, "A political victory, a rise of rents, the recovery of your sick or the return of your absent friend, or some other quite external event, raises your spirits, and you think your days are prepared for you. Do not believe it. It can never be so. Nothing can bring you peace but yourself. Nothing can bring you peace but the triumph of principles." One reason for being just toward others is that such action may cause them to reciprocate in kind. But, as I have said, a better reason is that kindness and justice toward others develops positive character in all who do so. You may withhold from me the reward to which I am entitled for rendering you helpful service, but no one can deprive me of the benefit I will derive from the rendering of that service insofar as it adds to my own character. The Golden Rule applied to capital and labor. We are living in a great industrial age. We see the evolutionary forces working great changes in the method and manner of living, and rearranging the relationships between people and the ordinary pursuit of life, liberty, and earning a living. Everywhere we see evidence that organized effort is the basis of all financial success, and while other factors enter into the attainment of success, organization is still of major importance. This industrial age has created two comparatively new terms. One is called capital, and the other, labor. Capital and labor constitute the main wheels in the machinery of organized effort. These two great forces enjoy success in exact ratio to the extent that the Golden Rule philosophy is understood and applied. harmony between these two forces does not always prevail. During the past 15 years, I have devoted considerable time to studying the causes of disagreement between employers and employees, and I have also gathered much information on the subject from others who have been studying this problem. There is but one solution that will, if understood by all concerned, bring harmony out of chaos and establish a perfect working relationship between capital and labor. The remedy is based on the great law of nature and has been well stated by one of the great men of this generation in the following words. Editor's Commentary. We include this quoted material for your information with due apology for there having been neither a reference to its source nor any indication as to who this great man may have been. The quoted material begins. The question we propose to consider is exciting deep interest at the present time, but no more than its importance demands. It is one of the hopeful signs of the times that these subjects of vital interest to human happiness are constantly coming up for a hearing, are engaging the attention of the wisest men, and stirring the minds of all classes of people. The wide prevalence of this movement shows that a new life is beating in the heart of humanity. Operating upon their faculties like the warm breath of spring upon the frozen ground and the dormant germs of the plant. It will make a great stir. It will break up many frozen and dead forms. It will produce great, and in some cases, it may be, destructive changes. But it announces the blossoming of new hopes and the coming of new harvests for the supply of human wants and the means of greater happiness. There is great need of wisdom to guide the new force coming into action. Every man is under the most solemn obligation to do his part in forming a correct public opinion and giving wise direction to popular will. The solution for the problems of labor, of want, of abundance, of suffering and sorrow can only be found by regarding them from a moral and spiritual point of view. They must be seen and examined in a light that is not of themselves. The true relations of labor and capital can never be discovered by human selfishness. They must be viewed from a higher purpose than wages or the accumulation of wealth. They must be regarded from their bearing upon the purposes for which man was created. It is from this point of view I propose to consider the subject before us. Capital and labor are essential to each other. Their interests are so bound together that they cannot be separated. In civilized and enlightened communities, they are mutually dependent. If there is any difference, capital is more dependent upon labor than labor upon capital. Life can be sustained without capital. Animals, with a few exceptions, have no property and take no anxious thought for the morrow, and our Lord commends them to our notice as examples worthy of imitation. Behold the fowls of the air, he says, for they sow not, neither do they reap nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feedeth them. The savages live without capital. Indeed, the great mass of human beings live by their labor, from day to day, from hand to mouth. But no man can live upon his wealth. He cannot eat his gold and silver. He cannot clothe himself with deeds and certificates of stock. Capital can do nothing without labor, and its only value consists in its power to purchase labor or its results. It is itself the product of labor. It has no occasion, therefore, to assume an importance that does not belong to it. Absolutely dependent, however, as it is upon labor for its value, it is an essential factor in human progress. The moment man begins to rise from a savage and comparatively independent state to a civilized and dependent one, capital becomes necessary. Men come into more intimate relations with one another. Instead of each one doing everything, men begin to devote themselves to special employments and to depend upon others to provide many things for them while they engage in some special occupation. In this way, labor becomes diversified. One man works in iron, another in wood. One manufactures cloth, another makes it into garments. Some raise food to feed those who build houses and manufacture implements of husbandry. This necessitates a system of exchanges, and to facilitate exchanges, roads must be made, and men must be employed to make them. As population increases and necessities multiply, the business of exchange becomes enlarged until we have immense manufactories, railroads girding the earth with iron bands, steamships plowing every sea, and a multitude of men who cannot raise bread or make a garment or do anything directly for the supply of their own wants. Now we can see how we become more dependent upon others as our wants are multiplied and civilization advances. Each one works his special employment, does better work, because he can devote his whole thought and time to a form of use for which he is specially fitted and contributes more largely to the public good. While he is working for others, all others are working for him. Every member of the community is working for the whole body, and the whole body for every member. This is the law of perfect life, a law which rules everywhere in the material body. Every man who is engaged in an employment useful to body or mind is a philanthropist, a public benefactor, whether he raises corn on the prairie, cotton in Texas or India, mines coal in the chambers of the earth, or feeds it to engines in the hold of a steamship. If selfishness did not pervert and blast human motives, all men and women would be fulfilling the law of charity while engaged in their daily employment. To carry on this vast system of exchanges, to place the forest and the farm, the factory and the mine side by side, and deliver the products of all climes at every door, requires immense capital. One man cannot work his farm or factory and build a railroad or a line of steamships. As raindrops acting singly cannot drive a mill or supply steam for an engine, but collected in a vast reservoir become the resistless power of Niagara, or the force which drives the engine and the steamship like mighty shuttles from mountain to seacoast and from shore to shore, so a few dollars in a multitude of pockets are powerless to provide the means for these vast operations, but combined, they move the world. Capital is a friend of labor and essential to its economical exercise and just reward. It can be, and often is, a terrible enemy when employed for selfish purposes alone, but the great mass of it is more friendly to human happiness than is generally supposed. It cannot be employed without in some way, either directly or indirectly, helping the laborer. We think of the evils we suffer, but allow the good we enjoy to pass unnoticed. We think of the evils that larger means would relieve and the comforts they would provide, but overlook the blessings we enjoy that would have been impossible without large accumulations of capital. It is the part of wisdom to form a just estimate of the good we receive, as well as the evils we suffer. It is a common saying at the present time that the rich are growing richer and the poor poorer. But when all man's possessions are taken into the account, there are good reasons for doubting this assertion. It is true that the rich are growing richer. It is also true that the condition of the laborer is constantly improving. The common laborer has conveniences and comforts which princes could not command a century ago. He is better clothed, has a greater variety and abundance of food, lives in a more comfortable dwelling, and has many more conveniences for the conduct of domestic affairs and the prosecution of labor than money could purchase but a few years ago. An emperor could not travel with the ease, the comfort, and the swiftness that the common laborer can today. He may think he stands alone, with no one to help, but, in truth, he has an immense retinue of servants constantly waiting upon him, ready and anxious to do his bidding. It requires a vast army of men and an immense outlay of capital to provide a common dinner, such as every man and woman, with few exceptions, has enjoyed today. Think of the vast combination of means and men and forces necessary to provide even a frugal meal. The Chinese man raises your tea, the Brazilian your coffee, the East Indian your spices, the Cuban your sugar, the farmer upon the western prairies your bread and possibly your beef, the gardener your vegetables, the dairyman your butter and milk. The miner has dug from the hills the coal with which your food was cooked and your house was warmed. The cabinet maker has provided you with chairs and tables, the cutler with knives and forks, the potter with dishes. The Irishman has made your tablecloth, the butcher has dressed your meat, the miller your flour. But these various articles of food, and the means of preparing and serving them, were produced at immense distances from you and from one another. Oceans had to be traversed, hills leveled, valleys filled, and mountains tunneled. Ships must be built, railways constructed, and a vast army of men instructed and employed in every mechanical art before the materials for your dinner could be prepared and served. There must also be men to collect these materials, to buy and sell and distribute them. Everyone stands in his own place and does his own work and receives his wages. But he is nonetheless working for you and serving you as truly and effectively as he would be if he were in your special employment and received his wages from your hand. In light of these facts, which everyone must acknowledge, we may be able to see more clearly the truth that every man and woman who does useful work is a public benefactor, and the thought of it and the purpose of it will ennoble the labor and the laborer. We are all bound together by common ties. The rich and the poor, the learned and the ignorant, the strong and the weak, are woven together in one social and civic web. Harm to one is harm to all. Help to one is help to all. You see what a vast army of servants it requires to provide your dinner. Do you not see that it demands a corresponding amount of capital to provide and keep this complicated machinery in motion? And do you not see that every man, woman, and child is enjoying the benefit of it? How could we get our coal, our meat, our flour, our tea and coffee, sugar and rice? The laborer cannot build ships and sail them and support himself while doing it. The farmer cannot leave his farm and take his produce to the market. The miner cannot mine and transport his coal. The farmer in Kansas may be burning corn today to cook his food and warm his dwelling, and the miner may be hungry for the bread which the corn would supply, because they cannot exchange the fruits of their labor. Every acre of land, every forest and mine has been increased in value by railways and steamboats, and the comforts of life and the means of social and intellectual culture have been carried to the most inaccessible places. But the benefits of capital are not limited to supplying present wants and comforts. It opens new avenues for labor. It diversifies it and gives a wider field to everyone to do the kind of work for which he is best fitted by natural taste and genius. The number of employments created by railways, steamships, telegraph, and manufactories by machinery can hardly be estimated. Capital is also largely invested in supplying the means of intellectual and spiritual culture. Books are multiplied at constantly diminishing prices, and the best thought of the world, by means of our great publishing houses, is made accessible to the humblest workman. There is no better example of the benefits the common laborer derives from capital than the daily newspaper. For 2 or 3 cents, the history of the world for 24 hours is brought to every door. The laborer, while riding to or from his work in a comfortable car, can visit all parts of the known world and get a truer idea of the events of the day than he could if he were bodily present. A battle in China or Africa, an earthquake in Spain, a dynamite explosion in London, a debate in Congress, the movements of men in public and private life for the suppression of vice, for enlightening the ignorant, helping the needy, and improving the people generally are spread before him in a small compass and bring him into contact and on equality in regard to the world's history with kings and queens, with saints and sages, and people in every condition of life. Do you ever think, while reading the morning paper, how many men have been running on your errands, collecting intelligence for you from all parts of the earth, and putting it into a form convenient for your use? It required the investment of millions of dollars and the employment of thousands of men to produce that paper and leave it at your door. And what did all this service cost you? A few cents. These are examples of the benefits which everyone derives from capital. Benefits which could not be obtained without vast expenditures of money. Benefits which come to us without our care and lay their blessings at our feet. Capital cannot be invested in any useful production without blessing a multitude of people. It sets the machinery of life in motion. It multiplies employment. It places the product of all climes at every door. It draws the people of all nations together, brings mind in contact with mind, and gives to every man and woman a large and valuable share of the product. These are facts which it would be well for everyone, however poor he may be, to consider. If capital is such a blessing to labor, if it can only be brought into use by labor and derives all its value from it, how can there be any conflict between them? There could be none if both the capitalist and the laborer acted from humane and Christian principles. But they do not. They are governed by inhuman and unchristian principles. Each party seeks to get the largest returns for the least service. Capital desires larger profits, labor, higher wages. The interests of the capitalist and the laborer come into direct collision. In this warfare, capital has great advantages and has been prompt to take them. It has demanded and taken the lion's share of the profits. It has despised the servant that enriched it. It has regarded the laborer as menial, a slave, whose rights and happiness it was not bound to respect. It influences legislators to enact laws in its favor, subsidizes governments, and wields its power for its own advantage. Capital has been a lord, and labor a servant. While the servant remained docile and obedient, content with such compensation as its lord chose to give, there was no conflict. But labor is rising from a servile, submissive, and hopeless condition. It has acquired strength and intelligence, has gained the idea that it has rights that ought to be respected, and begins to assert and combine to support them. Each party in this warfare regards the subject from its own selfish interests. The capitalist supposes that gain to labor is loss to him, and that he must look to his own interests first, that the cheaper the labor, the larger his gains. Consequently, it is for his interest to keep the price as low as possible. On the contrary, the laborer thinks that he loses what the capitalist gains, and consequently, that it is for his interest to get as large wages as possible. From these opposite points of view, their interests appear to be directly hostile. What one party gains, the other loses, hence the conflict. Both are acting from selfish motives, and consequently must be wrong. Both parties see only half of the truth, and, mistaking that for the whole of it, they fall into a mistake ruinous to both. Each one stands on his own ground and regards the subject wholly from his point of view and in the misleading light of his own selfishness. Passion inflames the mind and blinds the understanding, and when passion is aroused, men will sacrifice their own interest to injure others, and both will suffer loss. They will wage continual warfare against each other. They will resort to all devices and take advantage of every necessity to win a victory. Capital tries to starve the laborer into submission like a beleaguered city, and hunger and want are most powerful weapons. Labor sullenly resists and tries to destroy the value of capital by rendering it unproductive. If necessity or interest compels a truce, it is a sullen one, and maintained with the purpose of renewing hostilities as soon as there is any prospect of success. Thus, laborers and capitalists confront each other like two armed hosts, ready at any time to renew the conflict. It will be renewed, without doubt, and continued with varying success until both parties discover that they are mistaken, that their interests are mutual, and can only be secured to the fullest extent by cooperation and giving to each the reward it deserves. The capitalist and the laborer must clasp hands across the bottomless pit into which so much wealth and work has been cast. How this reconciliation is to be effected is a question that is occupying the minds of many wise and good men on both sides at the present time. Wise and impartial legislation will, no doubt, be an important agent in restraining blind passion and protecting all classes from insatiable greed. And it is the duty of every man to use his best endeavors to secure such legislation both in state and national governments. Organizations of laborers for protecting their own rights and securing a better reward for their labor will have a great influence. That influence will continue to increase as their temper becomes normal and firm and their demands are based on justice and humanity. Violence and threats will effect no good. Dynamite, whether in the form of explosives or the more destructive force of fierce and reckless passion, will heal no wounds nor subdue any hostile feeling. Arbitration is, doubtless, the wisest and most practicable means now available to bring about amicable relations between these hostile parties and secure justice to both. Giving the laborer a share in the profits of the business has worked well in some cases, but it is attended with great practical difficulties which require more wisdom, self-control, and genuine regard for the common interests of both parties than often can be found. Many devices may have a partial and temporary effect, but no permanent progress can be made in settling this conflict without restraining and finally removing its cause. Its real central cause is an inordinate love of self and the world, and that cause will continue to operate as long as it exists. It may be restrained and moderated, but it will assert itself when occasion offers. Every wise man must, therefore, seek to remove the cause, and as far as he can do it, he will control effects. Purify the fountain, and you make the whole stream pure and wholesome. There is a principle of universal influence that must underlie and guide every successful effort to bring these two great factors of human good, which now confront each other with hostile purpose, into harmony. It is no invention or discovery of mine. It embodies a higher-than-human wisdom. It is not difficult to understand or apply. The child can comprehend it and act according to it. It is universal in its application and wholly useful in its effects. It will lighten the burdens of labor and increase its rewards. It will give security to capital and make it more productive. It is simply the golden rule embodied in these words. Therefore, all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. Before proceeding to apply this principle to the case in hand, let me call your special attention to it. It is a very remarkable law of human life, which seems to have been generally overlooked by statesmen, philosophers, and religious teachers. This rule embodies the whole of religion. It comprises all the precepts, commandments, and means of the future triumphs of good over evil, of truth over error, and the peace and happiness of men foretold in the glorious visions of the prophets. Mark the words. It does not merely say that it is a wise rule, that it accords with the principles of the divine order revealed in the law and the prophets. It embodies them all. It is the law and the prophets. It comprises love to God. It says we should regard him as we desire to have him regard us, that we should do to him as we wish to have him do to us. If we desire to have him love us with all his heart and with all his soul, with all his mind and with all his strength, we must love him in the same manner. If we desire to have our neighbor love us as he loves himself, we must love him as we love ourselves. Here, then, is the universal and divine law of human service and fellowship. It is not a precept of human wisdom. It has its origin in the divine nature and its embodiment in human nature. Now, let us apply it to the conflict between labor and capital. You are a capitalist. Your money is invested in manufactures, in land, in mines, in merchandise, railways, and ships, or you loan it to others on interest. You employ, directly or indirectly, men to use your capital. You cannot come to a just conclusion concerning your rights and duties and privileges by looking wholly at your own gains. The glitter of the silver and gold will exercise so potent a spell over your mind that it will blind you to everything else. You can see no interest but your own. The laborer is not known or regarded as a man who has any interests you are bound to regard. You see him only as your slave, your tool, your means of adding to your wealth. In this light, he is a friend so far as he serves you, an enemy so far as he does not. But change your point of view. Put yourself in his place, put him in your place. How would you like to have him treat you if you were in his place? Perhaps you have been there. In all probability, you have, for the capitalist today was the laborer yesterday. And the laborer today will be the employer tomorrow. You know from lively and painful experience how you would like to be treated. Would you like to be regarded as a mere tool? As a means of enriching another? Would you like to have your wages kept down to the bare necessities of life? Would you like to be regarded with indifference and treated with brutality? Would you like to have your blood, your strength, your soul coined into dollars for the benefit of another? These questions are easy to answer. Everyone knows that he would rejoice to be treated kindly, to have his interests regarded, his rights recognized, and protected. Everyone knows that such regard awakens a response in his own heart. Kindness begets kindness. Respect awakens respect. Put yourself in his place. Imagine that you are dealing with yourself, and you will have no difficulty in deciding whether you should give the screw another turn, that you may wring a penny more from the muscles of the worker, or relax its pressure, and, if possible, add something to his wages, and give him respect for his service. Do to him as you would have him do to you in changed conditions. You are a laborer. You receive a certain sum for a day's work. Put yourself in the place of your employer. How would you like to have the men you employed work for you? Would you think it right that they should regard you as their enemy? Would you think it honest in them to slight their work, to do as little and to get as much as possible? If you had a large contract which must be completed at a fixed time or you would suffer great loss, would you like to have your workmen take advantage of your necessity to compel an increase of their wages? Would you think it right and wise in them to interfere with you in the management of your business, to dictate whom you should employ and on what terms you should employ them? Would you not rather have them do honest work in a kind and good spirit? Would you not be much more disposed to look to their interests, to lighten their labor, to increase their wages when you could afford to do so, and look after the welfare of their families when you found that they regarded yours? I know that it would be so. It is true that men are selfish, and that some men are so mean and contracted in spirit that they cannot see any interest but their own, whose hearts, not made of flesh but of silver and gold, are so hard that they are not touched by any human feeling, and care not how much others suffer if they can make a cent by it. But they are the exception, not the rule. We are influenced by the regard and the devotion of others to our interests. The laborer who knows that his employer feels kindly toward him, desires to treat him justly and to regard his good, will do better work and more of it, and will be disposed to look at his employer's interests as well as his own. I am well aware that many will think this divine and humane law of doing to others as we would have them do to us is impracticable in this selfish and worldly age. If both parties would be governed by it, everyone can see how happy would be the results. But, it will be said, they will not. The laborer will not work unless compelled by want. He will take advantage of every necessity. As soon as he gains a little independence of his employer, he becomes proud, arrogant, and hostile. The employer will seize upon every means to keep the workmen dependent upon him, and to make as much out of them as possible. Every inch of ground which labor yields capital will occupy and entrench itself in it, and from its vantage bring the laborer into greater dependence and more abject submission. But this is a mistake. The history of the world testifies that when the minds of men are not embittered by intense hostility and their feelings outraged by cruel wrongs, they are ready to listen to calm, disinterested, and judicious counsel. A man who employed a large number of laborers in mining coal told me that he had never known it to fail to evoke a calm and candid response when he had appealed to honorable motives as a man to man, both of whom acknowledged a common humanity. There is a recent and most notable instance in this city of the happy effect of calm, disinterested, and judicious counsel in settling difficulties between employers and workmen that were disastrous to both. When the mind is inflamed by passion, men will not listen to reason. They become blind to their own interests and regardless of the interests of others. Difficulties are never settled while passion rages. They are never settled by conflict. One party may be subdued by power, but the sense of wrong will remain. The fire of passion will slumber, ready to break out again on the first occasion. But let the laborer or the capitalist feel assured that the other party has no wish to take any advantage, that there is a sincere desire and determination on both sides to be just and pay due regard to their common interests, and all the conflict between them would cease, as the wild waves of the ocean sink to calm when the winds are at rest. The laborer and the capitalist have a mutual and common interest. Neither can permanently prosper without the prosperity of the other. They are parts of one body. If labor is the arm, capital is the blood. Devitalize or waste the blood, and the arm loses its power. Destroy the arm, and the blood is useless. Let each care for the other, and both are benefited. Let each take the golden rule as a guide, and all cause of hostility will be removed, all conflict will cease, and they will go hand in hand to do their work and reap their just reward. This concludes the extensive quotation on the subject of capital and labor. We now return to Napoleon Hill's words. My Code of Ethics. It seems almost an act of providence that the greatest wrong and the most severe injustice ever done me by one of my fellow men was done just as I began this lesson. This injustice has worked a temporary hardship on me, but that is of little consequence compared with the advantage it has given me by providing a timely opportunity for me to test the soundness of the entire premise of this lesson. The injustice to which I refer left two courses of action open to me. I could have struck back at my antagonist through both civil court action and criminal libel proceedings, or I could have exercised my right to forgive him. One course of action would have brought me a substantial sum of money, and whatever joy and satisfaction there may be in defeating and punishing an enemy. The other course of action would have brought me the self-respect that is enjoyed by those who have successfully met the test and discovered that they have evolved to the point where they can repeat the Lord's Prayer and mean it. I chose the latter course. I did so despite the recommendations of close personal friends to strike back, and despite the offer of a prominent lawyer to do my striking for me without cost. But the lawyer had offered to do the impossible, because no man can strike back at another without cost. Not always is the cost of a monetary nature, for there are other things which one may pay that are dearer than money. It would be as hopeless to try to make someone who was not familiar with the law of the Golden Rule understand why I refused to strike back at this enemy as it would be to try to describe the law of gravitation to an ape. If you understand this law, you also understand why I chose to forgive my enemy. In the Lord's Prayer, we are admonished to forgive our enemies, but that admonition will fall on deaf ears unless the listener understands the law upon which it is based. And that law is none other than the law upon which the Golden Rule is based. It is the law through which we must inevitably reap that which we sow. There is no escape from the operation of this law, nor is there any cause to try to avoid its consequences if we refrain from putting into motion thoughts and acts that are destructive. I have incorporated this law into a code of ethics that anyone who wishes to literally follow the injunction of the Golden Rule might appropriately adopt. My Code of Ethics. Number 1. I believe in the Golden Rule as the basis of all human conduct. Therefore, I will never do to another person that which I would not be willing for that person to do to me if our positions were reversed. Number 2. I will be honest, even to the slightest detail, in all my transactions with others, not only because of my desire to be fair with them, but also because of my desire to impress the idea of honesty on my own subconscious mind, thereby weaving this essential quality into my own character. Number 3. I will forgive those who are unjust toward me with no thought as to whether they deserve it or not, because I understand the law through which forgiveness of others strengthens my own character and wipes out the effects of my own transgressions in my subconscious mind. Number 4. I will be just, generous, and fair with others always, even though I know that these acts will go unnoticed and unrewarded in the ordinary terms of reward, because I understand and intend to apply the law through the aid of which one's own character is but the sum total of one's own acts and deeds. Number 5. Whatever time I may have to devote to the discovery and exposure of the weaknesses and faults of others, I will devote, more profitably, to the discovery and correction of my own. Number 6. I will slander no person, no matter how much I may believe another person may deserve it, because I wish to plant no destructive suggestions in my own subconscious mind. Number 7. I recognize the power of thought as being an inlet leading into my brain, from the universal ocean of life. Therefore, I will set no destructive thoughts afloat upon that ocean, lest they pollute the minds of others. Number 8. I will conquer the common human tendency toward hatred and envy and selfishness and jealousy and malice and pessimism and doubt and fear. For I believe these to be the seed from which the world harvests most of its troubles. Number 9. When my mind is not occupied with thoughts that tend toward the attainment of my definite chief aim in life, I will voluntarily keep it filled with thoughts of courage and self-confidence and goodwill toward others, and faith, and kindness and loyalty, and love for truth and justice, for I believe these to be the seed from which the world reaps its harvest of progressive growth. Number 10. I understand that a mere passive belief in the soundness of the Golden Rule philosophy is of no value whatsoever, either to myself or to others. Therefore, I will actively put into operation this universal rule for good in all my transactions with others. Number 11. I understand the law, through the operation of which my own character is developed from my own acts and thoughts. Therefore, I will guard with care all that goes into its development. Number 12. Realizing that enduring happiness comes only through helping others find it, that no act of kindness is without its reward, even though it may never be directly repaid, I will do my best to assist others when and where the opportunity appears.